usually pretty quick on the trigger, but after Ann does that to you, you know, you have to try and think of something pretty good.
I think the reason that I'm...
All right, it won't record except right here. All right, well, I'm going to use that, BJ, so I may have to carry this around with me. I have a voice that doesn't need one of these as a rule, so I think the reason that I may be your speaker tonight is also written perhaps in the history of the approach that our firm has taken to this field. In the late 50s, we thought that all communications should be consistent, and so we began doing advertising along with our public relations work, and it's odd to recall now, but that was a revolutionary idea, this thought that all communications would come out of one central location. The trouble is that at that same time, people involved in public issues and in product sales were beginning to formulate a new concept. You may not be aware that it's that new, but it was only in the 50s that the concept of marketing, as we know it today, really began to evolve. And so we moved from the total communication sphere and merged with that the marketing concept and what we could glean from management studies, and tried to put all of that together. And an interesting thing happened, and that is that when you look at the science of management, as much as it is a science, and when you look at communication and then the broader implications of total public relations, and when you look at marketing and you put all of those together, you discover something. They are all almost exactly the same thing. And that's really what I want to concentrate on sharing with you tonight, is what we've learned about that. The title that I've been given is an interesting one because you can read it two ways. I think it goes like this. Obviously, they don't want... You see, this typical Dayton Hudson, no red ink. My title is Marketing THC's Competitive Edge. Now, you can read that two ways. You can read Marketing Dayton Hudson's Competitive Edge, or you can read Marketing Dayton Hudson's Competitive Edge. And that's an interesting distinction because something has happened in the executive suites and the places where us workers live and so forth over the past few years around this term marketing. It's in your firm, in your company, it's, I think, reflected in a move from strategic planning, if you will, to strategic marketing, terms that if you're not already familiar with, I'm sure you're going to become very familiar with. And of course, it all goes to this new competitiveness that every kind of institution is finding in our country. When you look at new competitiveness in retailing, and this is something that as a professional I am forced to look at rather frequently for our clients, you find that it seems to boil down to three things, all of which you could tell me better than I can tell you. One, there's too doggone many stores out there after the same business. Two, they're cookie cutter stores. It's hard to tell one of those stores from the other of those stores. That's why I'm really not awfully concerned if you say that each of you are divisions of Dayton Hudson, because frankly, by the time Federated starts telling who their divisions are and the others start telling, nobody is going to understand any of it or probably give a hoot. That's the key thing, probably give a hoot. And the third thing is that the customer has now realized this surfeit and consumerism is rife. They're damn skeptical, as you know. They're demanding. They're tough. And when you put all of that together, you have a competitive situation. And yet those are only the things we talk about. What concerns me is whether there are some other issues, whether there's something else there that we still aren't looking at that may be even more significant in this competitiveness. I think that if you look at marketing as a concept that has certain benefits for organizations, then you have to be very careful, as you always do, to look at marketing and say, what benefits does it have for the consumer that marketing serves? And when you start asking those questions, of course, then you start asking, well, I'm going to be competitive, and I'm going to use marketing, perhaps, in its broader sense, as a tool for that competitiveness. But how am I going to do it? What's the tool? What's the theme that's going to make me more competitive? Is it better stores? Is it better merchandise? Is it better service? Is it better value? All those things that you have to struggle with every day, and we all know how the pendulum swings from value to design and to service, and over the years you can just trace those swings. I am concerned that it is going to be none of those. I may be wrong, but I don't think in the new competitiveness in the retail community that better stores are probably possible. Although you never know, they say that's true about hotels, and I was in Alaska not long ago, and the hotel they put me in there is owned by one of the Indian tribe corporations, and the whole lobby is done in jade. Well, you know, they had the jade and they didn't know what to do with it, so they didn't trust the banks, they put it in a hotel lobby. Maybe you'll go to that, but I doubt it. Just think for a minute of your stores and how well does it target. I tell everybody, Target is the most psychologically perfect design anywhere. And then what do you do to me? You change the design. You see, it's going to be more psychologically perfect. But there's got to be a limit to this somewhere. There's got to be a limit, and I'm not sure that Dayton Hudson itself isn't pushing us to the limit when it comes to better stores. As for better merchandise, gosh, I really wonder. I really wonder how much further we can push that. I'm beginning to think that better is a term we really have to take a close look at. Because, boy, that's a word that is a tough one. You know, just that simple little word, better. And when I look at that word and start analyzing it as an applied behavioral scientist, because that's what I think we really are, here's what I see. I see that better, this competitive edge that we want to have, is almost entirely a perceptual thing. You couldn't prove to me 99 times out of 100 factually that anything you do is better than the next guy down the street. But it's a perception. In other words, it's something that we instill in people's hearts and minds and in their behavior patterns, and we reinforce that through peer contact and word of mouth and through the overt relationships and communications that we put forth, but it's ephemeral. And I think that's a great irony. In a day when business is moving toward new concepts like marketing, this buzzword marketing, it turns out that the dividing line may be as ephemeral as what many managers think public relations and public affairs are. I think that's an interesting irony and one that you ought to probably ponder. But you know, marketing has a lot of landmines, and we probably ought to talk about some of those landmines. I don't know how familiar those of you here are with marketing. Are you all pretty much up on the concepts that go along with this, do you think? Well, let me just zip through a little of this and see just where we are on this. The first problem when marketing comes into the thinking of an organization is semantic. Because right away, marketing does become a buzzword, and people start thinking marketing is a very, very broad concept, that it takes into account just about everything. And in fact, the American Marketing Association, which could not agree on a definition until 2 months ago, finally did agree on one. And it sort of says that marketing is cradle to grave, and everything along the line is involved. Now, the last thing anyone ever should do, because how many of these turf wars have we all been through, the last thing I think one should do is to get involved in those semantic arguments or in the turf wars that are apt to follow them. But I do think it's important to recognize what indeed marketing is and how it relates to public relations, to public affairs, and to other things that are involved in the mix of activities that go on. And so the first landmine, to me, is to dispose of that whole issue so that we, having a clear understanding of what marketing concepts can add, and what public relations and public affairs concepts must continue can then serve both management and our customers in a very direct way. It may be interesting, if you're not familiar with it, just to trace the history of some of these concepts. In fact, let's just take the three concepts of public relations, public affairs, management, and marketing. You may be interested in just kind of the history of how these things evolved. Public relations, public affairs is the oldest of the concepts. In fact, you can trace it back to about the 1860s. Actually, you can trace it back to Eve, as soon as there was Eve as well as Adam. Of course, there were public relationships and reputations and issues. I can assure you there were issues. And but I mean, in a sense of a vocational activity that could be applied to an organization, it goes to about the 1860s. It actually started when George Westinghouse and Tom Edison were arguing over whether America would be served by alternating current or direct current. In those days, it wasn't okay to be AC/DC. You had to be one or the other. And so Westinghouse went to the Pittsburgh Press and hired a couple of journalists and sent them out across the country. And then he hired a couple of speakers and sent them out across the country. And the first thing you know, he had a full-blown public relations campaign going. Of course, Edison felt he had to compete with that, and so he did the same. And so suddenly, full-blown is a cadre of people making their living doing at least some of the things that we do today. That was pretty primitive. It was largely press agentry. That was really the key to it. After all, there wasn't any other game in town except the local newspaper in those days. And so it moved into that sphere. Pretty soon, however, organizations discovered that these people could also communicate internally. And so the whole field of internal relationships was born. Some of you may have seen the recent television presentation involving Eddie Bernays and others in the history of one portion of public relations, the horrible disaster at Colorado Fuel and Iron, and you may recall that the upshot of that was that the Rockefellers put a lot of money into internal communication. The Rockefellers being the Rockefellers, other business owners followed suit, and internal relations became a pretty major portion of what was going on. Pretty soon, they said, well, shucks, you know, if you can do that, how about all these neighbors we've got out here? They're starting to get restive. We better build in a community relations function. And the first thing you know, you've got a fairly well-rounded picture. However, then they said, hey, you know what? This thing probably has political ramifications. We can probably get out there and make some changes in society, at least in laws, if we applied public relations, public affairs techniques and thinking to it. Believe it or not, this didn't really start being done in any kind of a way until the late 50s and the 60s. There are history of certain things happening, but it's only relatively recent that that has occurred. Then we realized that politics worked two ways. Sometimes it was aimed at us, and we had to be aware of the issues and deal with them. And I would say that that's probably the greatest change that has come about until about the last 10 years. In the last 10 years, there's been a significant change in this field. And the change is indeed from all of these things treated as a communications device to starting to be treated as indeed a relationship building device. And the difference being that communication is words and relationship is behavior. And so at the moment, public relations, public affairs is very much into a hard-nosed behavior orientation. The question is, can we motivate people to behave? And we're learning some interesting things about that that I want to talk about later. The point I want to give you here is that there's a long history in this. It's a very broad-gauged history involving many aspects of society. Now, if you look at management, you know, the first management studies were only done in 1900 by Freddie Taylor for General Electric, and they were pretty unpopular because they were time and motion studies, and the employees didn't think that was such a good idea. In fact, Taylorism is still rather a hated word among labor union people. It wasn't until shortly after that that some more studies were done, which seem in hindsight to have been very friendly, but they were funded by management only as a way of manipulating employees to produce more. And those are the famous studies at Western Electric, which some of you may be familiar with. You remember they took a group of female employees and put them in a room and then gradually increased the comforts in the room. Better chairs, better lighting, better paint on the walls, and the productivity went up. And then the person doing the studies went back to Harvard and productivity went down. And so they said, well, we better get him back here to find out why it went down. And this time he came back, took the chairs away, took the paint away, and productivity went up, because all they cared about was that some guy from Harvard was paying attention to them. The chairs had nothing whatsoever to do with it. Now, American managers, being relatively slow learners, many of them still don't understand the difference between the hygiene of the chairs and the motivation of this attention. But it was a relatively manipulative thing. And management sat in that mode for quite a long while. And then an interesting thing happened. The government got more and more involved in businesses because the income tax became a reality in 1913. And more families no longer owned the business. And so they had to share the stock and they had to report to someone else. And came this wonderful thing known as double entry bookkeeping. You know, to anybody today, my generation or younger, I mean, double entry bookkeeping is sort of something that's always been around. And so I was amazed a couple of years ago to realize that the IRS is still chasing four very large corporations in this country that are privately owned that refuse to go to double entry bookkeeping. See, if you go to double entry bookkeeping, you'd only have to tell the cash that went through your hands, but the assets that you've got also. And naturally, those people don't want to do that. So this was really a revolution to go to double entry bookkeeping. It gave the managers and the owners and the public a way of really looking at a business and evaluating it in pretty realistic terms. And that's an important change in management. Then the next thing that happened was that these older families found that the sons, by now multimillionaires, didn't want to spend all their time around the business. They wanted to live in Palm Beach and Santa Fe and eat diner and places like that. So the result was that professional managers came on the scene. Now you start to see real changes, because the boss isn't the boss because he's Joe the Fourth. He's the boss because he's been selected as that person with probably the best capabilities of running the business. It makes a lot of difference if you think of it that way. Then something else came along, and that was a new feeling of competitiveness. You know, there was a time when you could start almost any business to be an instant success because it was a vacuum of a market out there. People had some cash and they wanted products or services, and then suddenly that box closed and businesses had to start competing with one another. And so the emphasis on this and on this became tremendous, and the elimination of this became important, because in order to compete, you had to treat the folks who did the actual work in a different way. And so at the moment, I think you could fairly say that business is kind of stuck on a QWL, quality of work life, participative decision-making model. It's having a little hard time in some places deciding that that's okay. But as new younger managers or better trained managers or more perceptive managers come along, it's clear we're going to go there. Now, note what's happening here, that this history very much leads, not reflects, but leads this history. In other words, the public relations, public affairs professionals, in touch with all the constituencies, have been saying to this group, hey guys, you know, you really are making a lot of unnecessary static out there. Pay some attention. And if you don't believe me, and if you don't believe that management professors and managers are slow learners, then just read any of the management books that were popular that are now popular. The One Minute Manager, the Excellence books, those aren't management books. Those are public relations books. Just read the books if you haven't already. The techniques they talk about are almost universally things that the public relations profession has been offering as a potential for business to improve. Well, now let's look at marketing. Along in the 1950s, pretty late, comes this concept of marketing. What can it add now to this that will make us more effective, that will give us a competitive edge? I think it can add a lot of things. But if you're looking for some new ideas from marketing, don't expect it. The reason is that marketing's first postulation was the whole theory of audience segmentation. The trouble is that public relations people have been talking about target audiences for years, and most marketing texts, either the first or the second chapter, is called the theory of publics. All right, so we could say, well, that's just our old idea and they've picked it up. No, they've done something else with it. They have said, we want to target audiences not to communicate with them and we'll do all these wonderful things. They've said, we want to target audiences to bring about certain behaviors. In other words, they way back here were where we are now. So they have added already something, even though it was a public relations concept to begin with. The next thing that marketing said was that, you know, you really can't do much of any of this without tons of research. Now, we've always talked about research, but there's a difference. How many of you can honestly say that when you need the research to make a decision, you either have or find the budget to do it? Probably nobody in this room, few of us in the profession. Ah, but what we now call marketing began as a discipline called market research. And Ernest Dichter, with his motivation studies and a whole lot of other very important concepts, grew out of market research. Now, Peter Drucker thinks they should go back to that term. He thinks they've gone haywire. And in his latest book, he says marketing really ought to go back to being market research and crunch numbers. It's the only thing they do well. Well, you can agree or disagree with Peter, but I think he is, perhaps through overemphasis, making a point that the thing marketing does is to take concepts that may have existed somewhere else and follow through on them. I think there's a tremendous message for us as to how we can push the competitive edge in watching how marketing does follow through. The next thing that marketing decided was that it wasn't just something for consumer products where it began, but that it could be applied to industry, that is to say industrial production, industrial products and services. And then somebody said, hey, you know, not only that, you could probably market ideas. Well, gosh, one of the earliest phrases in public relations is the marketplace of ideas. The difference is that when you apply these marketing strategies to ideas, some interesting things begin to happen. The more recent developments in marketing are that nonprofits are now heavily into it. They do it all wrong. Hospitals run these ads like they were, you know, Sears Roebuck. You want to get your health care at Sears Roebuck, friends? Frankly, I don't even want mine from Dayton Hudson as much as I love you. I want it from somebody that has that little bit of professional standing, and you don't get that by running ads that it's hard to tell from the corner drugstore. But they'll catch on because the concepts are important to them. I think at the moment, the interesting thing that's about to happen, and I say about to, is that retail, the retail industry, is now going to adopt a lot of marketing techniques and philosophies. Now, you won't see a lot of change because you've been doing most of it all the way along, probably under the guise of public relations or some other management technique. But I think you're going to find that that term comes big into the retail sphere. I'm sensing it in the two or three retail corporate boardrooms that I hang around occasionally and with the people that I talk to who observe the industry. And I think that it's an important thing for us to be aware of. Well, if we, as public relations, public affairs professionals, are going to make a contribution now, knowing that this is where we all came from, and knowing also, you may be interested in knowing that Philip Kotler, down at Northwestern University, who's sort of the spokesman for the marketers, Phil, at a recent speech, stood up in front of 2,000 people and said, you know, he said, marketing really ought to be called public relations, but he said that other group got the name first. I quote that only to emphasize not the fact that there are these differences occurring someplace, but that rather those marketing skills ought to be endemic to us. We should know them as well as the marketers, and we should be able to practice them, because when you put marketing skills and public relations skills together now, you have something that is superlative. And if you're going to have a competitive edge, you've got to be superlative. That means you've got to be superlative in order to give Dayton Hudson and its operating companies that same competitive edge. Let's take a look, though, at actually, on a daily working basis, how these different disciplines help any organization. Here's marketing over here. What can it do? Marketing philosophy. And here's public relations and public affairs over here. What can it do? Well, the interesting thing is that if you diagram this behaviorally of what happens in an organization, you have to put another box right here, and in it you have to write the word sales, and you have to look at both of those as support systems for sales. I mean, that's why they both exist. If the sales aren't there, obviously you don't need either marketing or public relations, public affairs. So if we are willing to admit that over here where the exchange takes place, that's one of the great concepts of marketing, you know, that an exchange of something takes place, in our case, dollars for merchandise, then you have to start saying, well, you know, gee whiz, those buyers and merchants and all those folks, they're really the premier folks in this outfit. Well, of course, you've been saying that right along, but I don't think I have to tell you that there are other retailers in the world that don't feel that way about buyers and merchants, and they're going to find out now when this whole thing comes to pass. But if you're willing to admit that somebody's got to take the money, and that that's the key person in the organization, remember, the key person in the organization, I won't bother telling you that it's the most overlooked person in your organization and every other retail organization, but forget that. Somebody's got to arrange here, and then at the bottom, I want to be sure and put the clerks that take the money. What can these two groups do? Well, the role of marketing, essentially, is first of all, what I'll call product, in quotes, design. What do we offer to the customer? That is truly a marketing function. And then there's this whole question of appeal. How do we appeal to the customer? And that has to do with a lot of things, advertising, merchandising. And then there's this whole question of research of a marketing kind that the marketers really provide in a superlative way. Well, how about over on this side? Now, if you look at this, and I could lengthen the list, but let's just for the moment concentrate on these basic functions. If you look at all this, what we're dealing with here is economic man and woman. That's really what we're looking at. We're talking about affecting sales in a very direct way. Products that are designed, appeals that are made for those products, research that's done to enhance those two so that indeed sales take place. It's very hard-nosed, very clear-cut, very easy to measure. Now, on the other side over here, we have some different things. We do share research. I'm going to put that in parentheses because of what you all admitted earlier. But we do that and should do more of that. And then if you start looking at how we enhance sales, you have to start putting down words like trust. We build trust, perhaps. Maybe we build a reputation, if that's any different than trust. And we deal with the perceptions of those publics that are not totally involved over here in economic man and woman. In short, the difference is we have to deal in public relations with whole persons. And if you can just think for a minute of our job in dealing with whole persons and the marketer's job in dealing with the economic portion of persons, you begin to see immediately that no organization is going to be very effective if it doesn't take these three and link them very tightly into a cooperative relationship where the salespeople are premier, marketing is setting up that product environment, and then someone has to set up that other environment, the thing I was talking about at the beginning. Interestingly enough, this isn't all that difficult, frankly. I don't know how, short of having better people and a bigger budget, which is probably not likely to happen, one retail organization is going to surpass another here. We can all do the research. We can all do the product design. There'll be some judgmental flaws, and some companies will do better than others based on that, and there'll be some luck. But this is an area that's pretty, well, you know, marketers are number crunchers, and that's pretty defined. This is very defined. But this area, this is the area where there is room to do something that the other person, the other company, cannot do, because we are not now dealing in something that is so clearly defined as marketing. And it seems to me that that's the tremendous difference. And if you look then at what public relations, public affairs adds to the organization that marketing, for example, has no real portfolio in, probably no interest in, it's a rather interesting list. I'm not going to write it up there because my handwriting is so poor, but let me just go over the list with you. Internal relations and internal communications, dealing with the employees, that's something public relations does that marketing is not involved in. Is that important? Well, issues. When we get out there into the court of public opinion and we have issues, who deals with that? It's a public relations, public affairs responsibility. It's not a marketing responsibility. How about taking those crunched numbers and bringing them back down to real people, to human nature? Public relations, public affairs people have that responsibility in an organization because clearly people are not automatons. You cannot run organizations on crunched numbers. You've got to run them on real people. And so that's another opportunity. In fact, there are a lot of really wonderful stories about marketers coming into organizations with number crunching. I have a client right now that I'm sorry to say has taken its field sales personnel. It's a product manufacturing organization, very large, well-known one. The marketing department has put out so many requests for data that the product salespeople now lose one day of selling time while they're back in their office filling in the numbers. I think that's idiocy, and I trust the organization will too, but things like that can happen. Then there's a wonderful story about George Birmingham, who was in a church which ran a school, and the diocese got into marketing. Churches are big on both public relations and marketing these days, and they kept sending him these forms to fill in the size of his classroom. So for the first 2 or 3 years, he filled it in, and the fourth year he got it. He said, I sent him this stuff 3 times, so he didn't return it. But they pestered him and pestered him and pestered him, so he figured, okay, I'll fix him. So he doubled the size. Nothing happened. So the next year, he doubled it again. And the year after that, he doubled it again, until pretty soon his classroom was somewhat bigger, you know, than the Colosseum and the Cow Palace put together, and nothing happened. So he wondered about all this collecting of data. Does this sound familiar to anybody here? You have any forms like this? So the next year, he wrote down, where it said size of classroom, the size of a postage stamp, and clearly put it down in centimeters. And nothing happened. George made some conclusions from all of that, which unfortunately, because it's a mixed audience, I cannot repeat. But that's what does happen in companies. Now, is that productive? Is that the way to build good relationships and efficiency? No, it isn't. Somebody has got to stand up to that and say, look, we love you marketing folks. You're doing good things for us, but let's bring some of this down to human nature. I think that's us. I think if we don't do that, we are not true to all the other things that we espouse. So that's another thing we do that they don't. And then there's a whole question of, if you follow the precepts of marketing, marketing is based on essentially the precept that we meet the needs and values of the customers. Now, if you follow that to its extreme, it becomes totally pandering. What do we do then when we have an issue, like the current B. Dalton issue around freedom of speech? Do we just pander to our public? Is that what we do? If that's what they want, we just give it to them? Or is there that point in the life of every organization when there are values that must be adhered to? I think we would all agree there is such a point. And therefore, advocacy, public advocacy, is something that public relations adds to the mix, and public affairs, certainly, that marketing is not concerned with. Then, there's another very important point. How about the non-consumer environment? Marketers really are and ought to be interested in the customers. Who can I draw in to behave in the way that means taking dollars out of the wallet and spending them? But the world today is not run in such a simple way. We all know that. The government, society, special interest groups, they determine what happens to a large extent in our country, in our communities. Somebody's got to deal with them. And that somebody is public relations and public affairs people. Howard Chase, a very thoughtful person in our field, postulates that today management has two roles. It used to be they thought they managed for profit. Now he believes they must manage for public policy and profit. It's kind of a double bottom line, if you will. Not an easy job, but then ask yourself, who's going to help them manage for public policy? That, I think, is one of the great opportunities and challenges for us. And then there's that other audience that Ann alluded to, that marketing has almost nothing to do with the media. Certainly, public relations, public affairs people are specialists in dealing with the media, and that makes all the difference. I want to look at this in one more way, which may be interesting to you. Marketing used to say, and anybody here hasn't taken a marketing course? We've all taken marketing courses, almost all of you. Then you all know about the four P's, right? You had to learn all about the four P's. Remember those? Product, what are they? Price, place, and promotion. For years, we thought that was the way you succeeded in a marketing sense. But we've learned a lot in recent years because organizations that were excellent in all four of those have not done well. So the first place we looked was we said, there's a fifth P. How about packaging? We can't change our particular product or our particular store or whatever in basic terms, but we'll package it differently. You know, if you can't change the product, change the package. And certainly that is a P that has to be added to the list. But then we got to thinking about that and we realized that sometimes it takes even more than that, and that is that you have to put all of these together into another P that you've all been through, and that's this whole question of positioning. We've got to position the organization in the minds and the hearts of people so that they will begin to think of it in a different way, at least to think of it as differentiated from its competitors. Well, now we have to add in the very complicated modern competitive situation a seventh P, the one that probably supersedes all of the ones above, and that is the P of consumer and general public perception of the organization. Now, if you look at these, you'll see that those four really are pretty much a marketing responsibility: design of the product, the pricing, the place where we offer it, and the promotion, the advertising that goes along with it. My sense is, however, that it's tougher and tougher and tougher to be different in those areas. Therefore, these three, which essentially belong to public relations or public affairs, are the areas where we can be different. I think, as a result of this, that we have some opportunities that we have not even begun to understand. Let me see if I can put it for you another way. If you look at a successful organization, and we now, I think, have enough information to begin looking at organizations to discover what makes them successful. If you look at a successful organization, you can draw a model of it that goes about like this. It's a four-step model. This applies to any organization, big, small, whatever the product or service. Because organizations are not the product or the service, are they? Organizations are people. That's what makes an organization, a collection of people trying to do something together. Well, if you study carefully all the literature and the research that's been done, you realize that the first step is clearly a statement of mission. Every successful organization begins with a statement of mission. Some of them, unfortunately, are 6 pages long, but there is a statement of mission. If you look at a statement of mission, what you're really looking at is a statement of values. Now, that's an interesting concept because we know that if there's one thing that people in this country are seeking today, it's a return to some kind of sense and set of values. And so an organization, and I think this is rather pertinent to your earlier discussion about your philanthropy, an organization that can show its value system to the public has a competitive edge that simply cannot be done away with. There it is. Because people want values. Look at what people are doing. Why the rush to various religious movements? The woman who's prostrating herself in front of Penthouse, she probably wouldn't phrase it that way, but the woman who's doing that is expressing a set of values. And people are responding to that because they may not agree with her, but they see someone who cares about values and is willing to stand up for them. So if we have a mission statement which indeed embraces values, then we can do some wonderful things. Then we can determine what is our unique selling proposition. Now, the marketers, and marketing thinking, is important in knowing what your USP is, but I would suggest to you that since it is not a fact or something you can put your finger on, that basically it belongs in the sphere of public relations, and that we're the ones that ought to be very highly involved in that. Of course, if you don't have a mission statement and values, it's very difficult even to have goals or objectives. However, a mission and values is really something that just sort of sits there in terms of activity. So the next step in a successful organization is the building of a culture. Well, we're all probably tired of that phrase, corporate culture. But if you'll ask yourself, what is a corporate culture? It comes down pretty much to a question of shared values. Now note what's inherent there. There's a participation there, a quality of work-life feeling, which, as I diagrammed earlier, is pretty much where management is bottoming out at this point in time. Furthermore, if we have some shared values, then we start getting productivity and morale and teamwork and all of those things. And when we're called in to deal with an organization that has problems, that's the first place we look. If we go through the place and ask six people what are the values and they can't tell us, we know right away that not only has an opportunity been missed, but that there are going to be problems. The main thing, however, that a set of shared values gives you is one clear voice. It's the only way that anyone has ever discovered to get an organization to begin speaking with one clear voice, is to make sure that we have a set of shared values. You've all read the books on corporate culture. You know the techniques, how to identify the heroes, how to identify the role models. The difference is the heroes are usually dead and the role models are senior citizens, but you can work that out in your own organization. And then we learn all the good stories about the place. Let me ask you, if I went out to your various organizations and I went to some folks who've been around maybe a year or so, so they've had a chance to be oriented, and I said, hey, what are the good stories around here? Would they be able to tell me some good stories about how the place got started or what your values are, something that really reflected the values? You think they would? If they can, then I would urge you to go home and find those stories that reflect the values and make sure everybody in the organization knows them so well that they tell them at every cocktail party and church supper for the next 2 or 3 years, because that is how it is done. Interestingly enough, unless we have a set of shared values based on a mission, it is very, very difficult to build relationships. You can call those relationships interactions with the public. You can call them sales. Use whatever term you want. But those relationships are essentially the result of expressed values. Expressed values. Now, if an organization doesn't have some values, it's rather difficult to express them in any kind of a significant, consistent way. And when we can do this, and this is more, really, than just marketing, more than the price you're going to give me so I can rush in, or the great value that you're going to offer me, this goes into building loyalty, if there's any of that left in the world, some credibility for the organization, and some trust. I suggest to you that there's a strong role for public relations here. The interesting thing is that if those three steps are followed, then we begin to see a sort of a perpetual motion machine. Because then, an organization begins to have a reputation. Because a reputation, if you analyze it, is nothing more than understood values. Understood values. The interesting thing to me about this model of a successful organization is what it should say to us as public relations practitioners. This part here, we have a role in. But the key role there, in the sales sense, is going to be played by marketing, and our role is going to probably be with other audiences. This, however, is our baby. This is something in which we must have a strong input, because you're talking about something that has to be understood and communicated and reacted to by large numbers of people in varying settings, and certainly it takes...